Welcome to Port of Entry, an African American Studies podcast. We bring you cutting-edge scholarship, news of student success, and topics of community interest related to the African American Studies program here at the College of Charleston. I'm Camila Martin, Professor of African American Studies and English, and Director of the African American Studies program. Today's episode, titled DNA Doesn't Lie, focuses on an ongoing project here in the Charleston area, the Anson Street Burial Project, steered by nonprofit organization the Gullah Society, has sought to bring more attention to and thoroughly research the 2013 discovery of what were believed to be African remains during the renovation of the Gilyard Center. Those remains, as we will learn, were in fact those of enslaved Africans. To give us more insight about the Anson Street Burial Project and its relationship to DNA analysis, we have two special guests today. We have three special guests today. We have Raquel Flesks, who's completing her doctorate in anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania and has conducted dissertation research on the genetic diversity of colonial North American populations using modern and ancient DNA methods. Her research interests include exploring ancestry and migration patterns in modern and skeletal populations through mitochondrial and nuclear DNA haplogroup analysis. This includes understanding how cultural practices impact migration patterns and how that is reflected genetically. She is responsible for the ancient DNA extraction, sequencing, and analysis of the DNA samples collected from the 36 individuals uncovered in Charleston for the Anson Street Burial Project. We also have Dr. Theodore Shore. Dr. Shore is a professor in the Department of Anthropology and a consulting curator in the Physical Anthropology and American sections of the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. He is also head of the Laboratory of Molecular Anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania. He has worked in the field of molecular anthropology for nearly 30 years. While his research has focused on populations of Eastern Eurasia and the Americas, other studies have involved groups from Turkey, Georgia, Pakistan, India, Ethiopia, South Africa, Australia, and Melanesia. Dr. Shure is also the director of the North American Center of the Genographic Project, and over the past 12 years has conducted research with indigenous and native descendant populations from Canada, the Caribbean, Mexico, and the United States as part of this project. For the Anson Street Burial Project, Dr. Shure has coordinated the DNA sample collection and facilitated their analysis. He has also participated in and coordinated scientific outreach and is directing the writing and publishing of scientific reports resulting from this project. And our third guest is familiar to us. She is here on campus with us. We have Joanna Gilmore, who for today's purposes is wearing the hat of Director of Research and Interpretation for the Gullah Society. She's also an adjunct professor here at the college, teaching in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology. So welcome to you all.
Thank you very much.
Right. So our guests are back in Charleston to do a number of tasks, one of which is presenting a brown bag lecture today on campus titled Rethinking Race, Biology, and Genetics, a 21st Century Perspective, where Dr. Shure and Ms. Flesks will discuss the field of physical anthropology and the notion of race as biologically fixed, which may include eugenics, phrenology, and other forms of what many call pseudosciences. You can't see my air quotes around pseudosciences. So let's just jump into the conversation. Can you give me a brief history of phrenology and eugenics, and what is its connection to race and biology?
That's a big question, or that requires bring a very long answer, but essentially phrenology, in terms of defining what they are, phrenology is the study of the human cranium, its shape and its contours, and to some extent its size, for the purposes of determining the relative intellectual capacities and the relative, I guess you'd say, value, worth, or superiority inferiority of different peoples whose skulls differ from each other by these various kinds of features, and various maps of the cognitive and mental faculties were placed on the cranium based on the bumps and the curves of the cranium that accumulate through life experience, but also maybe part of the what you're born with. So this was used in various ways to basically create people of rank order behaviorally and to some extent racially for quite a while. And it was an outgrowth of an effort to try to classify people into different kinds of races and to designate them as having certain kinds of inherent or innate capacities, which were in fact fixed and therefore in some ways predestined them to certain kinds of actions or occupations or certain social statuses for their particular lifetime and for them as persons of a certain race. Mm-hmm. Eugenics was also to some degree an outgrowth of this. Basically, eugenics means good genes. It was a term invented by Galton, a cousin of Charles Darwin, to try to, out of concern for the poor and the feeble and the less viable classes of society, basically reproducing too much and the desire to find some ways of basically improving the gene pool of the human populations, and that in this way, it would be efforts to try to have those of higher classes essentially have more children and those of lower classes have fewer. But this, in terms of a theory, might be a good idea, but it was actually used to develop a whole variety of policies, including sterilization and of various kinds of persons, including those who had cognitive problems, those who had Down syndrome, those who were alcoholics, and so forth in this country. And it basically expanded to include any number of people, including people of different African Americans and others who were viewed as being somewhat socially undesirable, and ultimately led to eugenics policies, which we now know from Nazi Germany anyway, that led to the killing of millions of people. So it's not an unimpactful concept.
Absolutely.
In this respect, but it comes out of this sense that there are certain people who should reproduce who are a better fit basically mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. society, mm-hmm. and those who are less fit, and therefore the energies towards the reproduction of certain forms of society should be channeled in certain kinds of ways to the higher classes, basically to white people in a larger sense.
Absolutely.
And then emerging out of this Victorian sense of hierarchy and social hierarchy and racial hierarchy.
Okay. Want to add anything to that?
I think Tad did a great job summarizing that.
Okay, great. So then help me kind of marry the topic of today's lecture with that very broad history of eugenics, as we're kind of looking at the flyer and people are deciding whether or not they're coming to this lecture. One of the things on the flyer mentions this idea of race as biologically fixed. Now, how does that connect to the ideas behind eugenics, phrenology, and what is the relation to the Anson Street Burial Project with all of those things?
So maybe I can jump in with regard to the race and the biology, okay. That sort of notion, and have this segue into comments by Raquel and Joanna. So the talk is organized in a way in a sort of a historical overview of these concepts and what people were thinking and acting upon in the 17th, 18th, 19th century. I mean, even today,
sure.
In the 21st century,
absolutely.
You see the same kind of rhetoric that was used a couple hundred years ago or longer. About which races are better and why there are differences between races and so forth. And essentially what the talk is intended to do is to show that the notion of race as implying deep genetic divisions between human populations is wrong.
Okay.
That we actually have, we are actually extraordinarily similar to each other despite any outward physical differences that may appear. And that's due to the fact that we're a recent species. We've emerged only a few hundred thousand years ago. The diverse differences we see amongst ourselves are largely a byproduct of evolving in certain geographic areas after expanding around the world and being subject to sort of different kinds of environmental and selective pressures and so forth. But we aren't, the genetics does not show us to be subspecies or races. That is the way the term has actually been used in biology for other kinds of organisms. So that actually is, I think, a significant achievement of genetics these days, although, it's complicated people still use the word race to imply certain kinds of biogeographic populations because it's a shorthand for talking about this kind of historical circumstances that lead to diversity within
Absolutely.
Human populations. But the problem is perhaps is that there's an impoverishment of ways of being able to speak about this. We have to learn new ways of talking about notions of race or human diversity. So that's, I think, is going to be where the talk ends essentially, although it leads into the Anson Street study itself and how, by going through this history and seeing how we actually move away from this concept of race, we actually achieve a much better understanding of the nature of human diversity and what that means for our shared history, even if it's African-American individuals from the 18th century in Anson Street, or it's us in this room here today.
Okay, absolutely. So tell us more about what you've learned about the Anson Street Burial Project.
Well, my involvement with the Anson Street Burial Project has been primarily to be doing ancient D analyses. So that means basically taking skeletal samples from the Anson Street individuals and extracting the DNA out of them. I had to do this work at the University of Tennessee in their ancient DNA laboratory. And that's because you want to make sure that we're not extracting DNA coming from me or maybe from somebody else who's been around the Anson Street burials.
Absolutely.
We want to make sure that we're just extracting the DNA from those human bones. This lab is set up with, you know, positive pressure airflow, UV lights. I wear full protection equipment, so I'm basically dressed up in a full bunny suit all day.
Oh, wow.
But we undertook this analysis last fall, about 3 months, and the preservation of the samples was really great. So usually with ancient DNA, sometimes archaeological preservation can be a little bit so-so, but we were able to extract DNA from 31 out of the 36 individuals. Our first analysis was to do an overview of the mitochondrial DNA. So mitochondrial DNA is a small plasmid DNA that we all have that's inherited directly from the mother.
Yes.
So it provides us with a really great snapshot of our direct maternal lineages. Our analyses indicated that we have a diversity of African mitochondrial haplotypes, so coming from West Africa, Central Africa, some even in North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
We also identified an indigenous North American haplotype as well as a European haplotype. So this provides a little bit of wrinkles into trying to understand who and where these individuals come from. What is their history? What is their ancestry? Surprisingly, though, we found that there were nobody shared direct maternal kinship. So there were no overlapping mitochondrial DNA haplogroups. And that was really interesting because we found that there were a lot of infants, a lot of women, and a lot of men from all age ranges.
Oh, wow.
So this is a really thing that we're still trying to fully understand. We are going to be moving into doing whole genome sequencing. Actually, we just finished that a couple of months ago.
Okay.
And we have the data to analyze over this next fall. This will allow us to look at biparental ancestry. So ancestry coming from your mom, from your dad, their mom's their dad. So it's a more a larger overview of your ancestry. So we'll probe into kinship and maybe if there's intergenerational relationships and also ancestry as well. So maybe it's just one line of direct maternal ancestry that is from West Africa, but more generally, where are these people coming from?
Okay, wonderful. So I know you all also tested some local residents here in the Charleston area. Were there any connections with, I guess, present day DNA from residents living here and the burials that were analyzed?
Well, we're still kind of probing into that issue.
Okay.
So, to speak. So we did do basic mitochondrial DNA haplotyping on all of the individuals as well as your biparental ancestry. We did see some overlaps in mitochondrial DNA haplotypes between the Anson Street individuals and those of our study population, but we are still looking to see are they actually direct connections, and that's where that biparental, that whole genome ancestry testing will kind of take place. This will help us kind of understand both kind of the symbolic connection back with the past with historical Charleston, but then also kind of maybe perhaps a more tangible connection as well.
Absolutely.
So we also, in terms of the living descendant community, everyone here, maybe unsurprisingly, has from the biparental side has significant African ancestry, but of course some complexity of ancestries given the historical legacy of slavery and also the choices of family and intermarrying that's taken place as they've lived in Charleston, many of them for many generations. And I think what's exciting for them also is that some number of them are already involved in exploring their own genealogies and ancestries. And so well, you know, while DNA doesn't lie, air quotes around that.
Right.
But it does actually add a certain dimension to their inquiry, which allows them to extend, to look deeper into the past and perhaps more broadly across communities in both here in South Carolina, perhaps other places, to find familial connections and links to folks who they may well be part of their family in a variety of different kinds of ways.
If you want to go wash, now what are you going to use? If you want to cook soup, now what are you going to use?
Follow-ups here. So you, if I understand you correctly, because I am so not a scientist, the DNA that was extracted from the 31 of the 36 individuals, you're saying that even with the mothers and the infants, there's no direct kinship relationships that you've been able to discover.
That's correct.
That is very interesting. That creates a number of questions to consider. I mean, we know that mothers and children were torn apart often during the slave trade. But you would imagine if individuals were buried together, mm-hmm. there would be a purpose for that. So that is quite intriguing. And then I want to kind of go back to this idea of current residents, current people, such as myself, who are interested in their own ancestry and doing these at-home DNA kits.
Sure.
For lay people who have no background in the sciences and anthropology, what does it mean when you discover your haplogroup? For instance, I have mine here, a couple of letters and numbers that my profile tells me takes me back to, Central Eastern Africa. Mm-hmm. It's L3F1B1. And so what does that even mean for people who don't have the entryway into the hard sciences the way that you all do?
So the two questions are about the lack of kinship among the burials, and maybe this is something Raquel can speak to with regard to the organization of the burial ground and all the implications that this interesting data have about the lack of connection or relationships which need further resolution. But with regard to the types of the haplogroups, the nomenclature you're speaking about, I can provide a little bit of insights into that.
Great.
So basically, everybody belongs to one big mitochondrial or maternal tree.
Okay.
We all are part of it. And
right.
There are multiple different branches that arise as the DNA evolves and mutates and changes, and as people move from place to place where those changes occur. And so in just like surnames change with misspellings or amalgams of things, or you know, the one name is which is commonly used and another one is dropped and so mm-hmm. forth. DNA changes in that kind of way sort of periodically, creating these new kinds of branches. So in order to describe this kind of broad geographic change in all the different branches across the world, a letter and number nomenclature was devised to actually name each major trunk and branch and twig and little tendril and so
Got
forth.
It.
So that now, especially since we can read every single little base pair, every letter of the mitochondrial DNA genome, we can actually define what we all bear as a maternal lineage or a haplogroup.
Okay.
It means haplotype group. The haplotype is all the markers we have as individuals, and then the markers that are shared in common with other persons' haplotypes show them to have a maternal kinship. So the groupings then represent clusters of mitochondrial types which are all related and share common mutations, hence common origin.
Okay.
So we can define those with great precision now. And because we also have been mapping these mitochondrial types across the world and are beginning to understand their ebb and flow and their mm-hmm. emergence and so forth, we can then provide some background as to when we think they might have arisen, because we can assign times, or we estimate times the branches have arisen, and we can estimate based on the density of their frequency in different places where they're likely to have arisen,
okay,
or where they actually are concentrated in human populations today, and hence are likely source areas.
Okay.
Or some, even if it's a broad geographic area, it's a source area for the mitochondrial haplogroups, the mitochondrial types we bear, as a consequence of our deep maternal ancestries.
Okay.
Yeah. And building upon that with the ancestry individuals, so we take this concept of haplogroups and haplotypes. So the ancestry individuals do share haplogroups, so these kind of larger groupings of mutation that suggest similar ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what they don't have are same haplotypes, or those same specific series of mutations between individuals.
Okay.
So that's what we're using to designate between, do they have direct maternal kinship? Because if they do, if let's say I'm a mom and I have a child, we would have that same haplotype, those same series of mutations. Now, that doesn't mean that when we look at this biparental that we won't see some relationship, like paternal relationships or potentially uncle or aunt relationships or things like that. So it doesn't predetermine that there won't be any relationships.
Okay.
But it is really interesting, and it was a very big surprising find that when we were going through that we didn't see that, because there are mothers, infants, fathers, and the distribution of the burials is in this basically four perpendicular rows, or four parallel rows to each other, excuse me. We have small children buried next to adult women, adult males buried next to infants as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we really expected to find some sort of relationships between these. And this maybe probes us into thinking deeper about what kinds of connections were they, maybe non-biological forms of kinship, non-biological forms of community formation. We know that the burials were, and the individuals were placed with intention, being so wrapped in shrouds with copper, with pins, placed in coffins. We see burial like nails surrounding the bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the placement of the individuals as well, with hands placed deliberately over the top of individuals, suggests care.
Right.
So I think when we are looking more into documents surrounding these individuals, Grant Mishu, who's part of our archivalist for the team, is working really diligently on this. But the problem is that we don't have a ton of documents on these individuals. Maybe we have a plat map or two, which shows the position of where it would be on a certain person's land, but we really are struggling to find the names and identities of these individuals. So that's where the DNA can kind of come in to talk a little bit more about understanding identities and origins and who these people were.
So the project is centered on the African remains discovered in 2013, but your work is far-reaching in the Charleston community. What are some of the other ways, and Joanna, perhaps you can answer this, what are some of the other ways that the National Geographic grants that are used to educate and engage current residents, particularly here in the peninsula, are being used? What else are you all doing with this huge opportunity to not only research and analyze, but also educate and engage the community?
Yeah, it really is a fantastic opportunity that has been provided by this, the focus, and by the discovery, really. Thanks to the funding, we were able to meet with community through the course of the past 2 years, really, to kind of not only talk to them about their own identity in relation to the 36 individuals and thinking about their ancestry, engaging them in the DNA research as well, but also asking what they envisage for the reburial and memorialisation going into the future, with our hopes to eventually build some kind of memorial on the burial site. We also worked with schools and Redux Contemporary Arts Centre to, we were able to engage five local artists to work with children and adults of all ages to create artwork that was used to create an exhibition for the reburial, where people created artwork that was inspired by the discovery. And that will be exhibited at McLeod Plantation this fall and going into next year. And we're hoping to take school children out to McLeod, and so that they can see their work there as well. And then on top of that, we've also got money to work with schools and develop materials where we can teach children about archaeology, anthropology, DNA research, their ancestry and genetics. So that's still ongoing, and we hope to find ways that that can be incorporated into local curriculums, because obviously that's something that's missing from the education down here. That sounds
really exciting, really exciting. And I was, I just have to say that the reinterment ceremony was one of the most beautiful things I've ever experienced. It was such an incredible week of events, the naming of the individuals and the care and the ceremony that the king of Oyotunji did to kind of consecrate the ground and give them the rights that they may not have received at the time of their actual burial. It was an incredible event, and so kudos to you all and the Gullah Society for being able to pull that together. It was wonderful. Question. I always like to try to make connections for students, right, who are interested in DNA and ancestry and cultural stuff, but they're not really sure how to make all of that happen. And so my last question is for students who are undecided about a career path. Can you talk a little bit about how this project merges African American studies as an interdisciplinary program with the STEM fields, particularly the sciences? You're using a lot of scientific phrasing here, and it's interesting because you're scientists, but you're also anthropologists. And I think the tendency is to think that anthropology is less scientific than it actually is. And so, could you perhaps speak about the merging of maybe the humanities and the sciences, and what possibilities there are?
What I'd like to do with this question is address why work on these issues is important, and why what we're doing is advancing the field. But then I can turn it over to perhaps to Raquel and Joanna to talk about how, what opportunities can students actually pursue in terms of concretely as to the opportunities with the anthropology within the STEM or STEAM fields. So this project, the Anson Street Burial Project, is significant because no one has ever worked with so many individuals of African descent from a specific cemetery, a burial context, and a historical placement that can be dated and has despite the fact it was sort of salvage archaeology, a fair amount was actually obtained about the background, as Raquel described, about the burials themselves and potentially about the persons. So this is a significant project in terms of what we'll be able to say about these persons in terms of scientifically and so forth, but also how we can actually can connect them to people here or to the history of Charleston.
Absolutely.
And the African diaspora and Charleston's role in the slave trade and so forth. So that's one thing that this project is going to make a significant contribution to, in which similar projects done by other students
Absolutely.
Here
mm-hmm.
could potentially be done as well. Another reason why this work on Africa or African history is important is not simply the fact that because of enslavement, people have lost some aspects of understanding of identity and culture and connection, although there's an active effort, of course, to reconnect in different ways. But because of the notions of race and race and biology, there's a misunderstanding about who Africans are.
Right.
Africa is the second largest continent in the world. It has millions and millions of people residing on it now and residing in it on the 17th and 18th century when significant enslavement was taking place. It's culturally rich, it's linguistically rich, and so forth. And now we're learning, especially when we're working with people of African descent here, but also in Africans themselves, is that there's an extraordinarily diverse place from a biological standpoint as well.
Absolutely.
And why that's important is because there's been the assumption that anybody who's African or African American is basically the same biologically, And that's also true for medical treatment, a whole variety of things which have real life implications.
Absolutely.
So the work of the we're doing now is opening up eyes to the reality that you can't, these assumptions are not correct, and that you really have to sample broadly in Africa. You have to involve people of African descent in medical studies. You have to do work which is directed to them as a diverse population. And this work, while it's not simply anthropological, is genetic and medical, and it actually is really important in terms of healthcare and health outreach to communities who've been distrustful of the medical community for a whole variety of reasons. Not simply the ignorance of African diversity, but other sorts of reasons that actually extend from more or less sort of racial notions about susceptibilities and vulnerabilities and relative health statuses and so forth. Tolerance of pain, all these sorts of things we know about, the historical legacy of scientific racism penetrating into the medical research. So this work and students who get involved with it can be advanced in a whole variety of ways. And there are many opportunities because we now have this understanding that we're around the cusp of actually enlarging understanding of what it means to be African, African descended, what is Africa, and so forth. And this is where these fields that we've been in sort of bringing together provide the opportunities that other Raquel and Joanna can comment on.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you for that.
Well, as part and parcel of this project, bridging off of what Tad has said, is to be involving the community the entire way. We are doing this work because we were invited and brought in because the community wanted to do that work. And we think it's really important as we continue to move forward to continue to involve students all throughout this project. I'm a student myself. I'm in my sixth year of my PhD. This project came in and now is forming my dissertation, which is really wonderful. We've also brought in another College of Charleston student to come train in our lab last summer at AME. He was wonderful. So he actually was able to do the mitochondrial DNA characterization of the contemporary African and African descended persons here in Charleston. So that was really great to talk with him. He's now in medical school at Drexel University. So he's now in Philadelphia, which is great. So we have him back in our flock.
Yeah, that's right.
But and when we were working with him, and also part and parcel with my own experience as a molecular anthropologist, we talked a lot about how do we bridge the STEM, the use of science, within an inherently social science and humanities context. And what I found about anthropology that is so beautiful is that we are able to bring those two together.
Yeah.
We use science to engage the community. We use science to try to understand the lives and identities of these individuals to then have conversations about slavery in Charleston, the history of Charleston,
Absolutely.
To begin this dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what the power of anthropology is that we can bring in scientific techniques, but then use them to answer questions of anthropological importance.
Mm-hmm.
In my own dissertation, it's been a really great tool because I thought I was awful at science when I was in high school. Oh my gosh, I was like, I didn't take AP Bio. I thought I wasn't any good at it. And then I realized that, no, I shouldn't be limiting myself to be doing this. I should... And in a way, science becomes a way to empower you to be able to answer these questions from a slightly different perspective, to give you a different edge or a different
Absolutely.
View.
Absolutely.
So I think this project has been really great in allowing for so many perspectives to be brought to the table, from young to old, scientific to the documents, to the humanities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I'd just add that from the Gullah Society side of things, we within our team we have a lot of different kind of disciplinary backgrounds: education, anthropology. My background's more archaeology, museum studies, and then combined with working with Raquel and Tad from the science side, it's been great just to have those conversations in terms of forming the project as a whole and thinking through these different perspectives. Is it just shows you the benefits of interdisciplinary research and work within communities.
Right, wonderful, right. And my work is more cultural. I'm a literary scholar, but a lot of what I do is I need to understand culturally, right, the history of African Americans, why indigo is used in certain ceremonies, or what the king of Oyutunji was doing at the burial site, right? So it's this incredible full circle for me, and I often push my students, African American Studies students, to kind of think of it that way, like, we have all of these different disciplines, right, merging together, right, to create this new narrative, right, to tell the story that we could not tell individually as individual scholars. So I think it's this incredible opportunity. I'm so grateful for the Gullah Society, the city of Charleston, for allowing African-American studies to tangentially be on the outside, right, and help you all to do some of this work. So I appreciate your time. Best of luck with the lecture and your continued research. And we look forward to hearing more about what we discover about the Anson Street individuals.
This podcast is a production of the College of Charleston's Teaching and Learning Team.